Dr. George Dimitri, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
Over the past 5 years, 51% of all FDA-approved cancer drugs have had substantial input from Dana-Farber scientists and clinical investigators. And that comes from the culture here, the very basic curiosity-driven scientists that are probing really how cancer works.
At Dana-Farber, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Why are these variations so broad?
Good morning, I'm Taylor Wilson, and this is 5 Things You Need to Know Tuesday, the 2nd of March, 2021. Today, how vaccine distribution varies state to state, plus the latest on COVID relief and more. Here are some of the top headlines. Parents and children separated at the U.S. border could be allowed to live in the U.S. after they're reunited. The Department of Homeland Security said Monday that they're working to reunite families either in the U.S. or their countries of origin. Protests continue in Myanmar after last month's military coup. Police fired tear gas on protesters in the city of Yangon on Monday, and security forces killed at least 18 people across the country on Sunday. And it's Read Across America Day. It'll look a little different this year, with students learning virtually around the country, and the National Education Association is pivoting from focus on Dr. Seuss to a number of diverse children's books. States and counties are getting better at knowing what exactly is required to get COVID-19 vaccines into arms. That includes things like sending letters to seniors and cold calling people to sign up. But distribution still varies because of the nation's fractured and underfunded health system. And it's led to broad disparities in state vaccination rates. Health reporter Elizabeth Weiss has more.
USA Today has the COVID-19 vaccine tracker where we list every day an update of what percentage of each state has gotten the vaccine. And I'd been looking at it, and there's real wide variety. I mean, 23% of people in Alaska, 12% of people in Utah. And so we started asking people, well, why are these variations so broad? And there's no one simple single reason. One of the things that most stands out is smaller and more rural states actually are doing better as long as they have pretty reasonably funded public health systems. Like New Mexico is doing brilliantly. New Mexico also created a great online and phone appointment system that doesn't crash and that is really easy to use, and you can pre-register. So everybody in the state could go in and pre-register, and when their cohort came up, they would actually get a call or an email saying, okay, great, now come and sign up. One fascinating thing I found is that one thing that matters is how many counties you have. And you're thinking, well, why does that matter? Because if you look at it, like Nevada has 16 counties. They can get every county health commissioner on one Zoom call and they can all talk together. Kentucky, which has 4 million fewer people than Nevada, has 106 counties. They cannot all get in the same meeting, or if they do, it's not going to be a profitable meeting, as any of us who've spent time on Zoom calls know. So you know, there's all sorts of things that are going into why some states are doing better than others, and some of them are surprising. Some states are really focusing on making vaccine accessible really broadly. I mean, Florida is doing that. Other states are focusing more on making sure vaccine gets to populations and communities that are hardest hit. So kind of an equity versus speed. And as we broaden out who's eligible to get the vaccine, that's going to become even a bigger issue. And that's something we're going to be watching because we don't exactly know what that's going to look like. It could be that vaccinating everybody you possibly can and kind of not worrying as much about equity, maybe that'll bring case rates down quicker. It could be that we know essential workers are more at risk and have higher rates of COVID. So we really, it's worth it to focus on those communities. I mean, not just morally, which it is, but broadly, because you'll bring case rates down and that brings them down for everybody. And so we'll be looking at that in the, I'm thinking the next 3 weeks is when that's going to hit.
Meanwhile, top public health officials warned on Monday to remain vigilant against the coronavirus. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky.
The most important thing you can do is to be ready to get the vaccine that is available to you. It will help protect us all from COVID-19. At the same time, I want to really keep our eye on the fact that our cases are increasing right now, slightly, but they are. And so, you know, the goal is not to sort of open up travel, open up all of, you know, things because people, you know, we're scaling up vaccination. The goal in those first 100 days has always been to sort of make sure that we are in a place to be out of this pandemic. At 70,000 cases per day, we're not in that place right now.
Sunday marked the first time in more than a month that most states reported rising cases, and more cases were recorded in the latest week than a week earlier. Globally, health officials are also stressing that the pandemic is not over and that this new reality may last for some time. World Health Organization Executive Director Dr. Michael Ryan.
It will be very premature and I think unrealistic to think that we're going to finish with this virus by the end of the year. But I think what we can, if we're smart, finish with is the hospitalizations and the deaths and the tragedy associated with this pandemic.
The WHO also continues to stress the importance of vaccine equity around the world, as Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said on Monday.
It's encouraging to see health workers in lower-income countries starting to be vaccinated. But it's regrettable that this comes almost 3 months after some of the wealthiest countries started their vaccination campaigns. And it's regrettable that some countries continue to prioritize vaccinating younger, healthier adults at lower risk of disease in their own populations ahead of health workers and older people elsewhere. Countries are not in a race with each other. This is a common race against the virus.
More than 2,537,000 people around the world have died from COVID-19. It's a big week for the U.S. Senate, particularly on pandemic relief. Senior video producer Hannah Gaber spoke with congressional reporter Nicholas Wu to break it all down.
It's kind of business as usual in the Senate this week, huh?
That it is, Hannah. So the Senate is back on their weekly schedule, and they will be working this week to confirm more of President Biden's cabinet nominees and will likely act to pass President Biden's $1.9 trillion stimulus plan.
So the House passed that over the weekend, right? So our checks are all in the mail, right?
Not yet. So what happened right now is that the Senate is currently prepping its own version of the bill and is making sure that all of its portions will be compliant with the special rules that Democrats are using to pass this package. The TLDR of that is that they use these rules that don't allow provisions that don't have a specific budgetary impact to stay in the bill. So like the $15 minimum wage, for example, can't stay in there. And there's other portions that could be at risk too, like certain child tax credit provisions. But the majority of the bill should remain the same, and the Senate is on track to pass it by the very end of the week.
And so then the checks are in the mail, right? Right after that, right?
No, they have to take one more step. So because the bill has changed, this means it'll have to go back to the House, and the House will have to vote on it again the week of March 8th. And assuming that nothing else changes there, then they'll be on track to send it to Biden's desk by March 14th.
Okay, and then the checks are in the mail?
Assuming that he signs it and that everything is in order, then the checks will be in the mail. And if you make under $75,000, which is the current proposal, you will get your full $1,400 check.
Well, thanks for keeping us posted on that. Do you anticipate any other major changes to the COVID relief bill?
Probably not. The only thing that we'll see here is that because Republicans are in the minority, they can't do a whole lot to stop this legislation. But what they can do is to bring up all sorts of provisions to amend this during what's known as a vote-a-rama. So the Senate is going to try to take this bill up later this week. Under the rules that they have for this procedure, there's only a certain amount of debate. But then members of Congress can introduce as many amendments as they want to this legislation. And these will be things that Republicans want to use to show their own points on the bill. So, for example, the last time the budget went through the Senate, Republicans trying to amend it with provisions that would strip funding from programs they didn't like, or to bar undocumented immigrants from receiving stimulus checks. So we're sure to see a lot of debate over that, and it's going to go late into the night.
But in the end, it's not really at risk of not passing. Is that correct?
Correct. I mean, it looks like Democrats will have the votes, even though the Senate is split 50-50, and it doesn't look like any Republicans are going to vote for this. It seems likely that all Democrats are going to vote for this, and then Vice President Kamala Harris will come in to break the tie.
And reconciliation, 51 people, that means it goes right on through, right?
Exactly. Reconciliation allows you to pass this with a simple majority, unlike the 60-vote threshold that you normally need to break a filibuster in advanced legislation.
The Supreme Court will hear arguments on Tuesday in a pair of cases that will determine when states can limit voting. 26 states allow voters to designate a third party to turn in their voting ballots, though 12 of them limit how many ballots a person may collect. And 10 states allow family members or caregivers to return ballots, but not third-party groups. Supporters say that ballot collection enfranchises low-income voters who work multiple jobs or can't access transportation, but critics see potential for ballot tampering and voter intimidation. They also point to a 2005 bipartisan report where former President Jimmy Carter and former Secretary of State James Baker recommended prohibiting it. Former President Donald Trump also slammed the practice during last year's election season, and there have been isolated cases of fraud connected with ballot collection. Though nonpartisan observers say that election fraud in general is very rare, and Trump himself allowed someone else to submit his primary ballot last year. The Supreme Court outcome could have far-reaching implications for the ability to challenge other controversial election laws. That includes voter ID requirements that critics say have a disproportionate impact on Black and Latino voters. The State Department spoke out on Monday about relations between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia amid tensions surrounding the death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The Washington Post journalist was captured and killed at a Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. An intelligence report found that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has absolute control over the country's intelligence organizations and said it would have been unlikely for the killing to have happened without his approval. The report said that more than a dozen Saudi security and intelligence officials killed Khashoggi and dismembered his body. The State Department has restricted more than 70 visas of Saudi nationals who are believed to have threatened dissidents overseas. Still, President Joe Biden does not appear likely to take direct action against the Crown Prince himself. State Department spokesman Ned Price.
We have made crystal clear, and will continue to do so, that the brutal killing of Jamal Khashoggi 28 months ago remains unacceptable conduct. At the same time, our relationship with Saudi Arabia is important. It's important to U.S. interests, and it requires continued progress and reforms to ensure that this important partnership rests on strong fundamentals and continues to advance our shared objectives in the Middle East.
The White House also addressed the situation during Monday's press conference when Press Secretary Jen Psaki defended not punishing the Crown Prince.
We also, from day one, even prior to the release of this report, have recalibrated the relationship, have made clear that it is going to be a shift from how it was approached over the last 4 years. That means counterpart to counterpart conversations. That means not holding back and voicing concern and pushing for action as it relates to dissidents or journalists or others being held. So our objective is to recalibrate the relationship, prevent this from ever happening again, and find ways, as there are still, to work together with Saudi leadership while still making clear where we feel action is unacceptable.
For more, you can search Saudi Arabia on usatoday.com. A massive iceberg has broken off of Antarctica. A crack in the Brunt ice shelf widened several hundred meters on Friday before the iceberg broke off, though British researchers in the area said it wasn't a surprise and was an event they've been expecting for years. Weather reporter Doyle Rice tells us the break was part of a natural process.
It's about 490 square miles in size, which is bigger than the five boroughs of New York City put together. So it's a pretty sizable chunk of ice. At the moment, it's still pretty darn close to Antarctica. And it's a natural phenomenon. It's not something that we have to really worry about as being end of days or anything crazy like that. It's just a kind of a natural process when this iceberg shears off of an ice shelf. The ice shelf itself from which it broke off was already floating on the surface of the ocean. So since it's just already floating, it's not gonna contribute any further to sea level rise, fortunately.
For all the latest on weather, climate, the natural world, and more, head to the weather section on usatoday.com. Thanks for listening to 5 Things. If you get a sec, go ahead and drop us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. You can also listen wherever you find your audio. Thanks as always to Claire Thornton and Shannon Green for their work on the show. 5 Things is part of the USA Today Network.
Dr. George Dimitri, medical oncologist, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
Over the past 5 years, 51% of all FDA-approved cancer drugs have had substantial input from Dana-Farber scientists and clinical investigators. And that comes from the culture here, the very basic curiosity-driven scientists that are probing really how cancer works, and then the expert clinicians that interact with patients and families every day. It's not easy to have input at a substantive level to new drugs that are safe and effective at treating cancer. So our whole mantra has always been to try to minimize risks to patients and yet try to maximize the opportunity of finding how effective a new treatment could be. And that means understanding cancer really, really deeply.
At Dana-Farber, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.